Yeah, just do it.
Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources, and one of my cohorts pointed out that at this very moment during the committee meeting might be a good time to work on the Wolf Bill, but we're not going to take that up first. So, okay, so we've got a couple of things to do today. We're going to start out with the public hearing on House Bill 4060, and then we're going to have a work session on House Bill 4007, and then we're going to move into House Bill 4040. So with that, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4060A, and I'd like to call forward Representative Wilson and Courtney Moran.
Members of the committee, Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative. Late in the day. Good to be here, though. Thank you. I want to thank you very much for hearing our bill. It's kind of hard to contain my excitement about this when I think of the impact that the rebirth of industrial hemp's going to have here in the state of Oregon. When I moved to Grants Pass in 1959 as a five-year-old, I was impressed even then by the acreage under tillage in Grants Pass, just right at the city limits between Upper and Lower River Roads, the fertile fields being covered with gladiola bulbs in full bloom. It was just an amazing thing to see the flowers out. We had a big commercial gladiolus bulb business in those days. We also had a rather large hop industry that went a long way to sustaining our valley. That's why I want to thank you for your attention to this bill. We believe that the birth or rebirth of industrial hemp in our state and in our valley will be a game changer. We've been struggling for many years now under the loss of our timber resources and the ability to get the and lay that up. And the thought of having something agricultural again that has a great end destination. This product is an amazing product that has so many, many uses. And to think that we could be part of that again. And I'll tell you, the people in my area are so excited about what you're listening to today when they consider the impact that it can have on the struggling Rogue Valley once again, because it has been a difficult number of years there. I am not an expert on industrial hemp. Everything I read excites me when I see what exactly can emanate from this agricultural product. But it's one of those things where we just have to look at our land, that so much of it is fallow around the city of Grants Pass now and used to be under tillage. And we just think, what could happen? We think of possibilities again rather than defeats and setbacks. And it is so great in my part of the world to look at wins, because we've looked at so many losses over time. And we've discussed here at length in the legislative session, both the long and the short, the urban-rural divide and the things that rural Oregon really needs to get back on top and regain its swagger again. We've been waiting for tourists, and when times are good, we get tourists, and tourism can be good. But we really need a base again, a base that we do not have. And so I'm just thanking you for hearing this today, realizing that this could certainly be part of what helps us regain our swagger and rediscover our agrarian roots. It's going to be great to see that again. So I want to thank you. I'd like to take my leave if I could. We have the House floor session underway, and I don't like to miss votes. But if there are any questions for me before I go, and I apologize for my throat and my voice, I'm succumbing to something today. And anyway, I just want to thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions, and if no questions, I'll be more than happy to turn it over to Courtney Moran.
Any questions for Representative Wilson?
I just have one question. Representative Wilson, isn't your legislative assistant related to my SIC chief of staff?
I'm not sure Chair Edwards and to Senator Whitson whether I really want to go very deep into that today.
Any other questions for Representative Wilson before he leaves? Thanks for introducing the bill for us and kicking us off here.
Thank you.
And good luck on the House floor.
Thanks so much. Great. Appreciate that.
Go ahead, Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. I'm Courtney Moran, and I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association. It's an association comprised of the majority of the existing industrial hemp licensees and over 15 entities or farmers that are interested in cultivating industrial hemp this upcoming production season. House Bill 4060A updates the provisions relating to industrial hemp and provides clarity to the Oregon industrial hemp farmers and to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and it brings the regulation of industrial hemp in line with traditional agricultural regulation in Oregon. There are four major issues that this bill addresses. First is regarding cultivation flexibility. Currently, industrial hemp is the only crop in Oregon that is required to be direct seeded into a field, meaning a farmer has to take a seed and take it out to the field. Now, the Department of Justice made this clarification on September 23rd. This was after we had 9 farmers already planting, believing that they had the right to cultivate in a greenhouse. So this clarification came out, and now these farmers were no longer able to be cultivating in greenhouses. And what this means is that there's an increased risk of cross-pollination when you have to direct seed into a field because you don't know exactly what you're putting into that field and what those seeds are going to become if they're males or females. So sections 1, 2B, and sections 5 specifically provide for allowing farmers to use clones, cuttings, and transplants in addition to using seeds, and also to use greenhouses and other agricultural buildings in addition to cultivating in fields. This promotes coexistence and reduces risks of cross-pollination. Farmers will know exactly what they're cultivating. They can sex their plants in their greenhouses before they take them out into the fields, and using clones and cuttings, well, they will be able to secure their genetics. And this also allows them to cultivate in a manner that traditional farmers cultivate. All other crops in the state of Oregon, farmers are allowed to use clones and cuttings and to use greenhouses, and we want industrial hemp farmers to be regulated the same way as traditional farmers are regulated in Oregon. The second two other issues are regarding testing. Currently, the Department of Agriculture goes out, they do an inspection of the field, they take a sample, and they bring it back to their lab. But this is cost prohibitive for the farmers because the department has been charging upwards of $95 an hour for the testing and the inspection, and $350 for the test. You'll hear from some farmers today about how cost prohibitive this has been for them. There's a farmer in Silverton, Oregon, who was charged about $850 for his inspection and test. And there is a farmer from Grants Pass who was charged $1,800 for his inspection and test. So what this bill will allow is the labs that are being accredited by the Oregon Health Authority and licensed by the OLCC to go out and do inspections and testing for these farmers. They will be able to have quicker results, and this is more economically feasible for them. And that's specifically provided for in Section 9. And this will authorize the Oregon Department of Agriculture to collaborate with the Oregon Health Authority on setting standards for the inspections, and also requires that all lab results are reported back to ODA so that they know that every crop has been tested, and if a crop tests above the 0.3% THC limit, ODA will be able to go out and do their own investigation and testing and inspections. Also in Section 9, you will find provisions regarding mandatory testing for all industrial hemp products intended for human consumption. This will be done by the same labs that are accredited by the Oregon Health Authority and licensed by the OLCC. The testing is in line with OHA and OLCC standards for marijuana items. We want to make sure that all industrial hemp products that are intended for human consumption entering the marketplace are safe, and we want to set that standard here. Fourth is regarding registrations and moving from a registration system from a licensing structure. Now, this is really more in language than in effect. Oregon farmers cultivating other types of crops are not required to get a license from the department. If you're growing wheat, you're growing potatoes, you're growing onions, you don't have to get a license or a registration from the department. But having the registration system will still provide for the Oregon Department of Agriculture to have complete oversight over the industrial hemp program. They will know who is cultivating what and where they are cultivating. This registration system still provides the Department of Agriculture a right to refuse a registration, a right to revoke a registration, and a right to refuse to renew a registration. This really brings industrial hemp regulation more in line with traditional agriculture in Oregon. It clarifies that industrial hemp regulation, or industrial hemp farmers will be subject to all regulations that other farmers are subject to in the state, including pesticides and water quality regulations. Registration is also compliant with the Agricultural Act of 2014, the Farm Bill, which contains Section 7606, and specifically subsection B1B2 provides that sites used for growing or cultivating industrial hemp in a state be certified by and registered with the State Department of Agriculture, and that's exactly what these provisions are providing for. So passage of House Bill 4060 is necessary for the establishment of a thriving industrial hemp industry in Oregon that can provide abundant economic opportunities to all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Courtney, for presenting what the bill does. Questions from Courtney by members of the committee? Quick question. What would you call the, what would you say is the nuanced difference between a registration and a licensure or license if the department can deny the registration? Or, and on what basis can the department deny the registration?
They can deny registration based, excuse me, Chair Edwards, they can deny registration based on any violations of the Oregon industrial hemp laws, the industrial hemp rules, or other agricultural regulations if there's any violations.
Other questions, comments? Okay.
And if I may approach, I brought the committee a hemp leaf that was harvested from a garden, the Hemp for Victory Gardens in Canby, Oregon, on September 24th.
That's in my backyard.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Seth Crawford, Dennis Wild, or Wildy, I'm not sure, and Matt Cyrus.
Look familiar?
I've seen one of those.
Yeah, imagine.
And I would suggest, we have a number of people signed up. I count 7 people signed up in favor. I count 0 against. I count a really strong House vote. I haven't heard of any controversy. So a piece of legislative advice would be short and sweet is probably preferred. Because you're probably at a yes and just talking your way to a no. So.
Good advice.
Go ahead.
Okay.
But feel free. I know people put a lot of thought.
I'll make this short, really short.
Heart into, you know, writing testimony and have driven a long way and stuff. So, you know, okay. I understand that. I'm just saying that, you know.
Chair and committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 4060. My name is Dennis Wild.
Wild, okay.
Wild, like Oscar. My wife and I have an organic farm in Oakland, Oregon, just north of Roseburg. We are currently growing olives for olive oil and hardy kiwi, the small ones, for fresh pack. We're an organic farmer, and we intend to incorporate organic practices into the growing of industrial hemp as well. For this coming year, we're planning on planting 18 acres of industrial hemp, the majority of that for seed and some for CBD resin extraction. We're supportive of this bill, and we're, as I don't want to reiterate what Courtney has already stated, but it's very important that we have the ability to start in greenhouses or grow rooms for the reasons that Courtney outlined. And it's particularly important to the recreational and medicinal growers who are concerned about getting cross-pollination from industrial hemp growers. One other point I would like to make, and then I'll turn it over to the next speaker, is under current ODA requirements, we have to have a separate permit or license and or both if there's any intervening crop. Even though we're on the same farm field, if we have an intervening crop, and in our case we have olive trees, we have some hemp, then we'll have the hardy kiwi, and then we'll have some more hemp. We have to have three two licenses and a permit in order to do that, simply because of some language that that DOJ inserted, which requires that it has to be contiguous fields. So having an intervening field is costing us substantially. So clearing up that language is important to us as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Matt Cyrus. I'm from Central Oregon and a sixth-generation farmer. Was certainly encouraged by the prospect of having a new cash crop in Oregon. In our area, in the 30s, we had we had clover seed. In the 40s through the 70s, there were seed potatoes. And since then, in the last 40 years, we haven't had any viable cash crops. We're intrigued with the possibility that we might actually have another one that would make agriculture viable again in our area. And we're certainly encouraged by the prospects. We appreciate your consideration. I might also mention that it's interesting to note that the state of Kentucky is embracing industrial hemp as a viable alternative to their tobacco industry, which is declining. So other states around the nation are certainly looking at this as a potentially new viable cash crop and one that would generate a myriad of products and help revitalize agriculture. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Seth Crawford. I'm a current industrial hemp license holder, and I had one of the inaugural crops from this last year in the state. I just wanted to thank you for hearing this, and I'll keep it very short. I feel like this bill is working in the legacy of Senate Bill 676 and 480 that Chair Edwards and Senator Prezonsky were so kind to give us in the last few years. I think this is a great step forward for Oregon to keep us competitive with other hemp-producing states like Kentucky and Colorado, as were mentioned. The one I want to just mention three quick things that haven't been mentioned. The testing requirements, I think, are incredibly important, and it basically codifies what I would say responsible growers and handlers are already doing in the state. And in addition to that, it's going to provide labs, OHA-accredited testing labs, with an important economy of scale to help assist both medical and recreational markets in terms of lowering costs for all producers. I think that's a win for everybody in the state. The greenhouse production provision is really important, especially in terms of being able to establish seed crops for foundation seed and for basically alleviating the existing seed shortage that we see here in the state, while also at the same time contributing to an alleviation of cross-pollination risks between cannabis varieties in the state. I think that's fantastic. The last bit of this, too, and I know that this is something that's being struggled with the Measure 91 Implementation Committee, is how do we make sure that we can transition the 47,000 small existing cannabis farmers in the state of Oregon into a formalized marketplace. At this point, because we are compliant with the 2014 Farm Bill, and this legislation maintains that compliance, Oregon can ship industrial hemp products to any state, to any consumer in the nation. And I think this is one of those opportunities that a lot of folks who are in the cannabis industry have been waiting for. And it's not the golden solution, but I think it's one of many that can help alleviate some of our leakage problems and to continue to allow the small farms to prosper with this very, very economically viable crop. Thank you for your time today.
How many growers did you say?
In the state last year, there were 13 original licenses issued. Two were handed back. Nine fields were actually planted, and I believe five made it to the final testing. So it was very, very small.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, what was the 47,000 number you mentioned?
That's for people who are licensed in the medical system, currently licensed to either grow or handle medical marijuana in the state.
Follow up?
Yeah.
How do we know? I mean, if you get the regulations to ship industrial hemp out of the state, how do we know we won't have a cross-pollination of that shipping and the wrong stuff go out?
The testing requirements are stringent with hemp, and I can tell you from experience that hitting the 0.3% THC concentration is incredibly difficult. It's part of the reason why so few farmers were able to sign up this last year. The testing that was done by ODA is it was very expensive, but on the other hand, it was also very comprehensive.
Follow up, I think you missed my question.
Yeah.
My question was, how do we make certain that those people that want to ship real marijuana out of the state don't ship it under the auspices of their shipping industrial hemp, which would put you guys in jeopardy?
I can't answer that for the folks who would be trying to do that.
Okay, could you follow up?
Yeah.
Can you answer another question for me? Ms. Moran talked about sexing the plants. What do? Walk in the greenhouse, ask them if they're a boy or a girl or what?
You do. It's
pretty much.
Yeah. In between the internode spacing, you can see either a female flower or a male flower once they are sexually mature. They don't start flowering immediately after that, but you can tell generally when they're anywhere between 3 to 4 feet tall, some varieties smaller, what their gender is.
Do you need to grow this like you would the regular marijuana with the grow lights and all that stuff?
You don't have to. Okay. What we do in terms of being able to maintain our plant stock for breeding purposes is to use a few lights to basically keep them from flowering, which is really important in maintaining that. But it's not something that you would be using. When you're growing fields of it, hundreds of acres, it's really not necessary to be using a lot of power in greenhouses other than just maintaining your breeding stock.
Last question, if you don't mind. Are they as water consumptive as regular marijuana?
They are, but it's no different than corn or any of our other major cash crops. Wheat and corn are very similar, both in nitrogen requirements and water requirements. And it's an incredibly malleable plant. You can plant it incredibly close together, 300 plants per square meter, or you can plant it wider apart, and you end up with a very different outcome for both the structure and some of the usable products that come out of the plant.
Philip, I heard a gallon of water a foot of plant. Is that correct?
It really depends on the conditions in the local ecology. I can say I grew 3.5 acres this last year, and at the peak of summer, we had plants on 10-foot centers, and we were using about 1,500 gallons of water per day. So it's working out to about 3 gallons per plant per day.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir Przanski.
I was going to say, regarding the difference in how it's grown, for the most part, industrial hemp's grown as a row crop, such as corn. Marijuana is not grown in that way because you're trying to get more production into the flowers and the seed and the flowers, and so the sun is different, so it's more of a bush type grow versus a rose crop. I read a lot.
I didn't say anything.
Any other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you each. Mowgli Holmes, Jenny Dressler, and Lynn Fouch. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, thanks for the chance to speak. My name is Mowgli Holmes. I'm the chief scientific officer of a biotech company here in Portland that is studying the cannabis genome. I've also served on the rules advisory committees for the OHA and the OLCC, and just recently was chair of the Oregon State Cannabis Research Task Force. And I am very, very much in support of this bill. So hemp has been an incredibly important agricultural crop for almost 10,000 years, since humans first domesticated any plants at all. And humans brought it to every corner of the earth with them. And in fact, I just recently found out that in the 16th century, sea voyages would never leave at the beginning of their voyage if they weren't carrying hemp seeds. And the theory was that if they were wrecked on a desert island, they could grow their own sails so that they would not be stranded. So hemp makes fiber that has transformed lots of different economies. It makes incredibly nutritious oil seed. And we now know that it makes the medically important cannabinoid CBD as well. Because it's the same species biologically as the plant that makes marijuana, as you all probably know, it's been a huge regulatory challenge building a rational industry around a plant that the federal government isn't supporting agriculture with. And this bill takes a few really massive steps towards creating that rational industry. It makes economic sense. It has testing guidelines that make scientific sense. And I think Oregon should be proud of its emphasis on being scientifically reasonable about these industries. I can also, I think, answer a couple of Senator Olson's questions about plant sexing. There are now ways to do much more rapid plant sex testing very soon after planting with new technologies. And as far as shipping overseas, I think that the emphasis in this bill on careful regulatory testing, and it'll have to be implemented correctly in rules, will completely remove any risk of other things being shipped. So in the medical marijuana system and the recreational marijuana system, we're testing and sampling in really methodical ways. We're going to be applying those same approaches to testing for hemp, and I'm sure that we can rely on the rulemaking process to make sure that everything is tested and doesn't have THC in it before it gets shipped out. And I just want to echo Seth Crawford's point about the economics of all the cannabis growers in Oregon. A huge issue that came up at a dozen different regulatory points in structuring the marijuana system is how to bring those small growers into the system, how to help them maintain their livelihoods, and how to avoid the possibility that they continue to produce cannabis and divert it out of the state in violation of the Cole Memo. And we've done a lot of things to address those issues, but giving them the potential to grow hemp is an incredible way to address all those issues and make sure that Oregon stays within the limits of the Cole Memo. So this is a good bill, and it should pass. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Edwards, and the committee members for hearing me on the HB 4060 and in favor of this bill. My name is Lynn Fouch, and I have a company called Integrative Health Source. And I started the research with the hemp plant with the CBD oils when I was training for the Olympic trials in Colorado and had some neurological things happen to my own body, and I came to Oregon to recover. And I realized that the CBDs had a lot of qualities, healing properties. So I really researched and got my husband involved, who is a 35-year veteran of emergency medicine as a physician and a retired colonel of 28 years, and he is also on that license to grow and cultivate marijuana. So we were one of the first original licensee holders last year, and we did put a crop in. It was unsuccessful because we got a crop in late, but my background really is passionate about what it can do for the physical body. But as I was running in the forest here in Oregon this last summer, I literally almost stopped and dropped to my knees because I looked around and I went, something is definitely wrong with the environment. And I could see it, I could smell it, and I could almost taste it. And I knew that the hemp plant, all the valuable properties that it entails, would help our environment, not only our environment, but the people with the economy. So I started reading more on the history of hemp, and I realized that I learned more on our history of our country and the world reading my hemp books than I did in all of my days of school and college. And Thomas Jefferson said, you know, it would revitalize, restore, and rejuvenate the economy if everyone would plant it. And I know for a fact, with all of the healing qualities that it has with the CBDs, with no THC, with what it's doing for children with cancers and seizures and whatnot, it's just incredibly beneficial. And I know that the stringent laws would be great to for us to test it to make certain that we were complying would be big on my list, because I am a stickler with medicine and what it's doing with the body. But most importantly, I know that there's some tension between the marijuana growers and the hemp growers, but I think I've often said, if you don't have a land, you're not going to have a land to smoke your marijuana. And I know that this hemp plant will do a lot and will save our trees. It will bring back it doesn't take much water. And I'm just a proponent for this. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. We're the state's largest ag association, representing about 7,000 members actively farming and ranching and 60,000 statewide. We're here today to support House Bill 4060. I will be brief in my remarks. You all have our written testimony. We had the opportunity last year to get to work closely with some of the hemp growers as some of the issues arose around coexistence, and we continued that relationship in the interim and learned a lot about some of the difficulties that they were actually having growing under the current license program. And we were happy to facilitate some discussions and to work with Department of Agriculture and the growers, with Courtney Moran and many of the growers that you have in the room today, to try to help build that flexibility back into their hemp program to create a program that works for the ways that folks are growing today. So in keeping brief, you have our testimony. We support House Bill 4060. Thank you.
I wanted to add one more thing. I have traveled to Australia in the last month to look at the decorticating machines from a gentleman that put out a phenomenal decorticating process for the last 22 years. So I'm in the making with that with a Colorado-based company, as well as securing seed potentially. So.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
What's the current hemp market like? What products can be made, and is that distribution system already set up and in place?
We,
in 5 minutes or less.
We import, I thought it was $8 million a year annually from other countries. Like, we get it from Canada, and then they would produce the products here. So we import the hemp milk, the hemp fiber. Can you add some other things here?
There's some hemp bricks. There's the potential for sustainable bricks, right?
Right. Like the hempcrete alone. I don't know if you guys know this, but we're in an earthquake area, right? So if you make a building with hempcrete, it's very strong, but yet flexible and bendable. So they're even looking at it being a great tool for the buildings to sustain high velocity of an earthquake, as well as a lot of people with environmental issues like autism and whatnot are building their homes with that because they're antimicrobial, antibacterial, and antifungal. So they're finding that these family members are healing when their building is made from this product. So those are just a few things. What else can you think of?
There's also a huge CBD market.
Yes,
for
CBD markets.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I only smile because when we talk marijuana, it's the godsend that heals all and cures all. That's what you were just saying here. I just giggle. I'm having trouble separating you hemp guys from the marijuana guys, especially when they said there's 47,000 marijuana growers and we just made it legal.
Right, right. What I do know,
big industry.
With the hemp plant versus the marijuana plant, though, you're not having the psychoactive properties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're giving to the people that's why I got interested in it, because I'm not a drug person, and I know marijuana is for whatever people will do it for, but I just don't like that psychoactive, and I know that kids are really benefiting. I just read another article of 15 seizures a day from a newborn child that was been giving the CBD oils, and no seizures.
Hemp was a big product in Korea in 1972.
So. Yeah. And the Israeli Army Force carries two things in their packs at all times for many, many years, hemp oil and morphine. Those two things. They never are without it.
What's the hemp oil for?
What's it for? It's amazing. They know the healing qualities of it. It can put you in a state of total bliss, but no psychoactive high. And if you have an injury, it can take away like rheumatoid arthritis or any aches and pains in the body immediately.
Other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you each.
Thank you.
So that's everybody that signed up to testify on House Bill 4060A. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4060A. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 4060A.
Chair Edwards, I move House Bill 4060A to the floor with a detailed recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved House Bill 4060A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Senator Przonski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to have this day today because it is something that's been a long haul. It took 12 years to get the bill passed to allow for industrial hemp to be grown in the state. We were successful in 2009 with the help of Senator Dave Nelson. And Senator Olson, Living Harvest is a company in Portland that deals with a lot of hemp products. It's amazing what they are putting out as to what it has for nutrition, as well as health and others. This will, when we put the bill together originally, because of all the scare and such, we had certain regulations that were in place, such as the 2.5 acres of land for growing. What we've realized is that that's not necessary, and it actually would help the industry to have these modifications. And so it will, in fact, allow for farmers to be able to do what their cohorts around the world are able to do. It doesn't make any sense to me that we were prohibiting our farmers from being able to grow industrial hemp. If you remember back in World War II, we had a Hemp for Victory program where the government was actually paying farmers to grow industrial hemp for the war effort. And unfortunately, it kind of fell on the wayside through marketing of other commodities that were in direct competition with industrial hemp and their products. And today, we'll be helping these individuals who are in the process of starting farms to be able to reestablish themselves in being the seed capital of the world in Oregon. Clearly, industrial hemp will have its place. Thank you.
All right. Other discussion from members of the committee? Okay, seeing none, are there any objections to the motion? We do have a motion, right? Yeah. Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And Senator Brzozinski will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 4060A, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 4007. You might remember, colleagues, that 4007 is the bill on the rangeland protection districts, and it would expand the definition of rangeland protection association. We had a county judge from Wheeler County that came and presented this bill to us, and we're in work session, so.
You're on.
And I'm still thinking of the 47,000. Man. Chair Edwards, I move House Bill 4007 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 4007 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries.
I'll carry it.
Senator Olson, would you like to carry?
If you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. Senator Olson will carry. And we will close the work session on House Bill 4007. Before we open up the work session on House Bill 4040A, I wanted to have a little bit of a committee discussion. This is a controversial bill that we are about to move into work session on, and it has this issue. We've taken this issue up for a number of reasons, and it's happening within the context, as much as I'm trying to keep this committee somewhat isolated from the hydraulics and the dynamics of a larger legislative session. It's not. And it's been this particular committee, the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources, handles a lot of controversial issues. If the issues are going to do anything. I personally am interested in working on issues that originate from around Oregon, whether they're in Portland or they're in northeastern Oregon or they're on the coast or they're in southern Oregon. That's my personal motivation. And I take these issues on as chair not because I particularly even care deeply about them, but I know that there are a lot of legislators that care deeply about the issues. And so, you know, whether or not it's suction dredge mining or wolf delisting or air toxics or canola or, I mean, any one of a number of other issues that we've taken up, in the past session, the energy issues, climate change. We do this because I take on some of these issues myself because I care about them. But frankly, most of the issues that we've processed through this committee are either brought by an agency or the governor's staff or legislators on this committee or legislators elsewhere in the building. And I hope that while we have a clear division in political views on this committee, I mean, it's really clear where the districts are that each of us represent. I would hope that we can continue to do our best to rise above the, I don't know what else to say other than gamesmanship. And I know that what seems like a principled stand to one party on one issue, seems like a game to another party on another issue, and we just, we have different views of the issues. I'm saying this because I personally lose a lot of sleep over these issues. And this, the wolf issue is one that I have spent a lot of time thinking about, not only in talking with stakeholders about, but also trying to figure out a way to move forward. And so I guess what I'm communicating both to the members of this committee and to a lot of stakeholders that are out there and watching this is that how this committee conducts itself matters to me. And if we are going to on every single controversial issue go down in a blaze of glory, whoever is not winning on that particular issue, then we have a choice, and that is to just narrow the scope of issues that we take on. Has to be bipartisan if we're going to take it on, or it has to be unless things are really bipartisan, there are always going to be disagreements on environment, natural resource issues. That's just the nature of the beast. Last legislative session, we passed 69 bills through this committee. Four of them were partisan. Only four of them were partisan. Of the four partisan bills that we passed, two of them had broad stakeholder support, but the members that voted against the bills did so because even though they were standing up for ratepayers, those were the recycling and the garbage and recycling bills. And the members of the committee that voted against those said, well, maybe all the recycling and interests and the garbage interests and everything voted for them, but I wasn't sent here to represent them, and I totally respect that. But even those two bills had a lot of support. The reason that they had a lot of support was because they had a professional agency. They had professional agencies that work in this stuff all the time, day in, day out. And stakeholders are coming to them and saying, well, if we could just do this or we could just do that, then they have work groups and they, and there's the wrestling that goes back and forth, and there's the weight of the governor's office and the governor's staff working on issues, and they work everything out before it comes here. And voila, things aren't quite as controversial. Having said that, that led the agencies really driving the bus on, 33 bills. There were 33 agency bills that were submitted to this committee last session. We worked 20 some of them. And then the legislators' bills that came were in all various forms of having been worked over. Some of them had really been developed a lot, and some of them were just kind of throwing things out there, I think, to kind of stir the pot. And those didn't get a whole lot of traction. We have a choice as a committee whether or not we are going to try to rise above our differences and treat each other respectfully, even when we're in disagreement, and conduct a fair fight, or We can, we can do the political thing, which, frankly, I think there's been way too much of, even when we disagree. So that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to get off my soapbox now. I invite comments from the rest of the committee before we move in to the work session. So, Senator Whitsitt.
Sort of a corollary here, I think, with industrial hemp. What was it, 12 years ago, thereabouts, that the people wanted to start growing industrial hemp, and they ran into problems with marijuana and pushed back there with a lot of regulations that were largely inappropriate, probably maybe still are inappropriate, but they slopped over. I think last year and this year, we maybe have almost reached a consensus. Probably not a consensus. Certainly a vast majority of legislators believe we got that sweet spot now. So I told you last week that Tom McCollum, the FNW wildlife specialist, had called me to tell me there was a wolf on Windy Ridge and Wildcat Ridge behind our farm ranch. And we had a discussion about what we could do, and where it is, nothing. I mean, unless it's attacking me or a person, we can't do anything. Mr. Angman told me a few minutes ago that there has been a 500-pound heifer calf killed in Swan Lake Valley, and they're still investigating it, but it certainly appears to be a wolf kill. That's on the other side. That's just on the north side of the ridge behind my ranch. So I may not be completely impartial in this situation. Mm-hmm. But I think we see a similarity. We see a ranching community and a farming community has come to try to work out their differences with environmental groups to try to be able to continue to farm and ranch and to live within the rules that are set up. And I think that's what this bill's about. Why I support it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I would support a lot more, but I don't think it's politically possible. So that's my point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we are going to open a work session on House Bill 4040. Is it 4040A or 4040?
4040A.
Open up a work session on House Bill 4040A. And I have, I'd like to invite the department and Brett Brown's come from the governor's office. If you folks can come forward. The department has submitted some information about, I'll let you describe the information. And I've asked Brett from the governor's office to come and give us some background on kind of how we got here.
Very good, I'll get us started.
Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Shannon Hearn. I'm the Deputy Director for Fish and Wildlife Programs at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We appreciate the opportunity to come during the work session. I mentioned last Tuesday, with litigation over this issue, it was a little touchy on things that we could say or not comment on. And through the hearing, as well as a flurry of email exchanges and letters, we kind of get a better understanding of the issues and the information that we could bring forward to give our perspective. So, for instance, one question we had from Senator Denbrough was what the issue was with the public review and the 24 hours notice during our commission meeting. Through the hearing, we were able to discern that there was a question about why we stopped taking public comment November 6th when the meeting was November 9th. And it reminded me that typically we do hold our commission meetings on Fridays. This time we held it on a Monday. It was going to be the only issue. There was going to be a huge volume of science and comments to review, so we gave our seven commissioners the weekend to review that. The last deadline for sending that out to them was Friday. However, public testimony remains open until they go in to make the decision. So most people brought their written testimony at that point if they hadn't met the November 6th date. So some information like that, we were able to tease out a few more facts that we'd like to bring forward. Ron's going to cover the peer review and science. You know, we're we're definitely open to any questions that you have involving the litigation as far as what we know and what we heard. As I mentioned, we've only seen a filing, so we don't have a lot of details on that. And then I'll finish up with just saying, this is my first legislative session, but I have been a field biologist for 18 years, and one of the things we really take seriously at the department is the science and our responsibility to wildlife resources in Oregon. So that's what we're trying to clarify and bring forward more. We thought originally just coming and ensuring that we followed the Endangered Species Act as, you know, passed by the legislature and met the five criteria, that was enough. Ron will provide some more details on that, hopefully. Hopefully it'll help.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. As Shannon stated, our entire process started with the spring of 2015 in review of the wolf status in the state and taking in front of the commission whether they wanted to have us consider delisting as the wolf plan contemplated. So we actually started a public review process of the wolf plan and the components associated with delisting in April of 2015, with the commission making a final decision in November of 2015. And during that time, we developed some scientific population viability analysis models that we put in front of the public and in front of the commission in the spring of 15. And we never received any comments on those until the fall of 2015 from outside interests. We did look at the criteria on what it means for verifiable science or scientific review, and there are two pieces that we look at in relation to that, according to the statute and then also according to the rules that the commission has adopted that guide us in doing that. And the commission rules very clearly state that verifiable means scientific information that's been reviewed by a scientific review panel of outside experts, but it does not state that there has to be an independent panel convened to review any information. And the rules also give some examples of what verifiable information would consist of. And so things such as articles and information published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, information developed by the department which has been peer-reviewed by outside experts such as management plans or technical reports, information developed by federal agencies which have been peer-reviewed such as management plans or EIS or environmental impact statements or adopted recovery plans, and then peer-reviewed data gathered by the department or others using standard methodologies or protocols. And we had all of that type of information included in our review of the wolf status in the state and in the review of whether wolves qualify under the five delisting criteria outlined in statute and by rule by the commission. Additionally, the department did solicit outside scientific review of the population viability analysis. We sent that out to eight different scientists, not only in the United States, but in overseas, and we did receive comments back from four of those scientists. And that is really not an uncommon thing, that when you're doing something like this and you're soliciting input, that you typically do not get responses back from everybody that you solicit input from. All of those scientists looked at the analysis and whether the scientific principles were correct, whether we had properly applied the model, and all of them came back and said that, yes, we had done that. And of note was one of the individuals was actually the author, the original author of the model, Dr. Bull out of Copenhagen, and he felt that we had applied the model correctly as he had published it, and he felt that the factors, the biological factors that we had put in made the model operate correctly. He didn't make any or offer any opinion on the outputs of the model, but whether the science behind it all was correct. In addition to that, in October of 2015, we sent out to stakeholders, government agencies, and other interested parties information and asked for input back on the proposals that the department had. And we had at that point three different proposals, one whether to delist, one whether to take no action, or the third whether to do a partial state delisting. And from that, we did get a lot of comments back. And you've heard from, and I've seen in some of the letters that you've received, that there was a lot of scientific input from a lot of different scientists that came back during that review. And really, when we reviewed those comments that we received from those scientists, we condensed them down into 23 substantive sets of comments that really dealt with science and that we felt should be addressed. And as part of our review of those 23 different factors, we compiled a seven-page document that was provided to the commission on each one of those 23 comments, how we felt that they were either applicable or not applicable to the decision in front of them, and if we made any adjustments in what it was we were proposing, what those adjustments were. In many cases, the scientific comments really are, you should have been more conservative than what you were in application of the model. In fact, when they had not fully understood some of the conservative measures that we had applied, and what they, in a lot of cases, were proposing actually would have presented a more liberal interpretation of the model. We also received an independent, unsolicited comment from Dr. David Meach, senior scientist with USGS, and probably one of the preeminent wolf biologists in North America. He's been studying wolves since 1958. If you've heard about the famous Isle Royale moose herd and the wolf interactions back east, that is Dr. Meach and his work. And Dr. Meach said that he felt that the review the department had conducted actually did indicate and show that wolves had met the delisting criteria as outlined by the statute. The effects of delisting, and what does that really mean? Whether they're delisted or continue to be listed. Under delisting, the wolf plan is still in place. Under delisting, there are still protections in place for those wolves that are in phase or in the western portion of the state because we treat them as if they are still listed in the western zone. And that's what the wolf plan calls for. And the different phases of the wolf plan that progressively allow more actions to be taken are the most restrictive in phase one. And the western portion of the state remains in phase one. And that western zone is essentially, for us, everything west of Highway 97 and then breaks off just south of Lapine down towards Lakeview, across Silver Lake, Summer Lake, Fort Rock Highway down to Lakeview and the California border. Everything east of that is in phase two of our plan, and for the areas where they are federally delisted, there are more options available for landowners that are experiencing damage. But even with that, those landowners are required to take non-lethal actions. Those landowners are required to meet the things within the plan to protect their livestock. And I would say that those landowners really have stepped up to the plate in a very convincing fashion to show that they take wolf management seriously and that they take the wolf plan seriously and have been implementing those things. And I guess to just kind of wrap up current status, you know, we just finished the calendar year, and at that point in time, we start doing our council wolves. This is still a little bit preliminary, but as of this point in time, the minimum wolf population, because we know we don't count all wolves in the state, The minimum wolf population is now 110 wolves. That's a 36% increase from last year. We now have 12 packs documented, and of those, 11 are breeding pairs, which is also an increase from last year. And we have four additional pairs of wolves identified in 2015 that we didn't have last time. And we'll be watching those this year to see if they actually form as a pack or a breeding pair. We have had in 2015, there were 9 incidents of wolf depredation that were confirmed by the department in 5 different portions of the state or 5 different areas. The depredation events have remained fairly constant over the last 2 or 3 years. Some of those, though, involved sheep, and there were a bunch of sheep killed as part of those depredation events, but we treat that as one event. And I would say that wolves are on track with what we've seen in the western states with the reintroductions in Idaho and Montana. Wolves in Oregon are following the same path currently and are increasing at the same rate. So that's a real high-level summary, Chair Edwards, and I'd be happy to answer any questions when you feel it's appropriate.
Thank you. We'll take questions of the whole panel after all three of you go. So, Brett.
Okay. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett Brownscomb. Work as a natural resource policy advisor to Governor Brown. I was asked to be here to provide some perspective on how we got here, and I do so as an employee who works for the governor. I also do so as someone with some history on the issue, dating back to living in LeGrand back in the early 2000s when the Wolf Plan was formed, and serving on the stakeholder committee representing wolf recovery interests at the time. And as you all deliberate through the bill and what to do, and knowing that it's controversial, and I guess there's a reason why wolves' songs are howls and not kumbayas, I thought I would share a little bit of background. There have been letters that have come into the committee and copied to the governor since Saturday. There are a variety of representations in the letter related to science, legal effect, protection. That's why Ron and Shannon and our Department of Fish and Wildlife provided some updated information on the backgrounder that you have related to science and the effect of delisting. We felt it was important to be clear on the record what science did the department use, what process did the department use, answer any questions you have related to that or other questions you might have as you deliberate on your decisions here. The governor's office position is neutral on this legislation, and there are reasons for that. But we want to be here to provide information that may be helpful. So how we got here, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's decision process was from the beginning set out as considering the biological status of wolves and the question of whether to delist, and those who have pointed this out before are right. The question was whether to delist. It was not a foregone conclusion. There was a process around the considerations related to delisting, including the listing, ESA listing factors. So that process was set to happen first. The second process was revision of the Wolf Plan and the rules related to the Wolf Plan, the OARs, which have the force of law. There was disagreement and a desire to take a different path on the part of those who are opposed to the bill and who are litigating the delisting decision. They wanted to see the Wolf Plan revision process happen first and the delisting consideration happen second, or to have them happen concurrently. There are a variety of reasons for this that I'm happy to get into, but that is not the path that the commission and the department were on. That's not the path that the commission and department chose to take. That was not the approach and ordering that various interests wanted the department and the commission to take. And so they entered into and engaged both the department and our office in a conversation about can we have a conversation before delisting happens related to the Wolf Plan and revisions to the rules under the Wolf Plan that they would like to see prior to the delisting discussion happening? That was not a position in which the department and the commission wanted to be put. That was not the ordering was such that those questions around what the rules should look like or if they should change and how, there was a place for that set, and it's to set to start this spring. Negotiating or being put in a essentially a position of kind of a quasi-settlement negotiation around a administrative rulemaking or Wolf Plan review process that hadn't yet started before the outcome of a commission decision that had not yet been made, the delisting decision, that was not a position that the agency and the commission wanted to be in. So we didn't go that route. That is part of how we got here today. I would say both with the litigation and probably both with this bill. There are concerns related to science and process that have been raised related to the litigation and opposition to the bill. But as far as our read on what the bill would do, this is a bill that it's the commission has acted in taking this action. The bill would make specific findings in the whereas clauses and then ratify the decision as being consistent with certain State Endangered Species Act provisions related to delisting. So in the face of ongoing litigation and whether to engage on this issue at a time when it is under litigation is a policy decision that is governor's office feels for the legislature to make. And that is a reason why we're neutral on this. The executive branch, the way we view it, has acted, and the commission made a finding and made a delisting decision. The judicial branch is engaged right now through ongoing litigation and will have a say on the matter one way or the other. And so I think the question is really, does the legislative branch, the other branch of our government, want to say anything on the matter? So I don't want to take up too much time and would like to be here to help with any questions, but one thing I wanted to end with is that on many of the arguments related to the bill, including the policy and the legal conclusions that seem to being offered up by the scientists that some of the advocacy groups are relying upon, those arguments seem to be premised on one thing, which is that the bill, or rather I should say delisting and the commission's decision to delist, equals some kind of a loss of or a significant reduction in protections for gray wolves in Oregon. And I think as Ron covered, there are administrative rules that continue to be in place that have the force of law that will be in place regardless of the listed or delisted status of wolves. I won't get into the details other than to say I think there's when people hear about delisting, they generally think of the federal context of delisting and the federal ESA. That's the context with which most people are familiar. And it's different than the scenario that we have here in Oregon. And it's different for a number of different reasons. At the federal level, Congress decided and took the action to delist gray wolves because this controversy over wolves has played out over time in a number of different states in a way that apparently compelled Congress to take the action. That was hugely controversial. In Oregon, we have not gone that approach. Bills that would have delisted wolves legislatively have not been advanced or have been defeated. And I know what I wanted to share in part is the governor feels strongly that we are not Idaho, we are not Wyoming, we are not we don't do things the way other states have done or that Congress has done. There is a very unique approach here in Oregon through the Wolf Plan and the rules tied to the Wolf Plan that has gotten us to successful recovery to date. So in the Wolf Plan process, the citizen recommendations that led to the Wolf Plan, it was foreseeable that this issue of delisted status or listed status was going to be a political football, and it was in every other state and has been since wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone in 1995 and even in the Great Lakes states. So the foundation of the plan and the rules intentionally set a course that put in place protections and recovery-based laws that are not dependent on the listed or delisted status, intentionally to try to not hinge Oregon's program on an issue that is one of fairly repetitive political football. So our approach has been collaborative in Oregon. That is how the governor would like to see it remain. It's obviously hard to do that when there is ongoing litigation, but the big picture is we're entering a phase of Wolf Plan revision, and this is set to begin in the spring. And the path forward there involves one where all parties are going to need to be at the table, and they're going to need to be working with the commission and the agency around what Oregon's Wolf Plan looks like moving forward based on what we've learned in the 10 years to date, 10 plus years to date. So it is helpful for the agency and all of the stakeholders to go into that process with a clear signal on the space that they're entering. And the big picture in all this, I think, that at least I wanted to share so as not to be lost in this, is not where we are in this moment in time around a delisting finding, but where we're going on wolf recovery and trajectory and the science that underlies the Wolf Plan and decisions around it. And so that's why I think what the department has submitted as to the science it's relied upon is valuable and maybe a little perspective on the context of how we got here. So I'll stop there and thank you.
Thank you each for being here. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion questions for you. Senator Woodsit.
Thank you, Chair.
And Senator Denbrough.
Edwards. First, Western Oregon includes the Modi Plateau, where I live and practice for years, and that is an area from the California border roughly to the Pine, and from Highway 395 to the Cascade Mountains, probably 12,000 square miles. To put it into perspective, it would be, if you went from Portland to Cottage Grove, 100 miles wide. That's what we're talking about. That's by this plan in Western Oregon. But what I wanted to talk to you about, Ron, was we've got about 110 wolves in the state now, and that includes a 36% increase that you know of in 2015. So if we just assume the same rate of increase, and biological systems go to and fro, but we know in Idaho and Montana and in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, we had pretty consistent growth at a very rapid rate. So if we take that 36% and move it forward, in 2016 we'd have 150 wolves in Oregon. In 2017 we'd have 205 wolves in Oregon. In 2018 we'd have 270 wolves in Oregon, which would be, you know, roughly 40 packs. So if we had that kind of growth in the wolf population and had 270 wolves in Oregon and 40 packs, where would we be in the wolf plan?
Chair Edwards, Senator Woodsit, you know, it really depends on what the revision of the wolf plan looks like. So under the existing wolf plan, we would, assuming that we had in Western Oregon, the wolf population was also growing, assuming that we had documented breeding pairs, and if we again, under the existing wolf plan, had exceeded 7 breeding pairs for greater than 3 years in a row, we'd be in phase 3 of the wolf plan, which is what we term the management phase of the wolf plan. So, again, that's based on the current wolf plan. We don't know what the new one will look like after we get through that collaborative process.
So we're, my point being, Mr. Chair, that we're well on our way toward that, well on the trajectory toward that recovery.
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, you know, the commission felt that wolves had recovered enough to be removed from the state ESA, that we still have not met some of the targets identified in the existing wolf plan for Western Oregon to move out of phase one into phase two. But wolves are pioneering the Cascades. They are pioneering the west side, if you will, and we are on that path.
I would reiterate the west side is where I live. Out in Eastern Oregon, but yes.
West side on the east side.
not that I want to make a point of that. Yeah. But.
Senator Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is a question for you, Brad. You know, looking back to when the Wolf Plan was first being formulated, was it ever envisioned that you would get to a point where there would be a decision whether to delist or something else, and that there might be judicial review called for at the end of that road? And if so, I mean, how was that discussed and you know, how was that talked about?
Chair, Senator Dembro, so during the planning process, everybody knew that at the point in time when the thresholds in the plan and in the rules were triggered to consider delisting, that day was always one that people knew would be controversial, and there were six packs of beer bet on when that day would come and how soon it would come. But and I would venture that a lot of people thought that day would be a lot farther out, where we'd be considering delisting than it has been, given the, and it's because of the pace of recovery that it is here, it has arrived sooner than later. The concept of, you know, that table was intentionally designed to try and resolve contentious issues outside of litigation. So we didn't, and almost intentionally, I think, didn't talk about, well, what if litigation happens around this day where delisting happens and we all know it's going to be controversial. The idea was to try to, and this is where Oregon's different, and it was outside the box at the time, and it probably still is outside the box. The rules, the laws that implement the plan and give it teeth, were crafted in a way to try to set aside this battle over listed versus non-listed and make sure that we had laws in place that are separate from the state ESA, that are OARs, based on the Wolf Plan, that require and ensure recovery happens on the west side, even though delisting may happen at a time when the populations on the west side were lower and are lower than the east side, and still require an upward population trajectory on the east side, which is what the rules do. So there were fallback mechanisms put into the plan about, okay, well, if delisting happens and the bets were wrong, so, you know, say wolves, people suddenly read a signal around delisting to mean open season or who knows what, all the fears that are out there around wolf recovery. There were backstops put in the plan about, okay, if populations start to decline as a result of delisting, then the commission would take this back up based on direction in the wolf plan and look at relisting based on those trends. And that's why the phase one versus phase two approach is meaningful. Phase one, after you get through that and move into phase two, and delisting can be considered, in this case was taken, or taken as an action by the commission, that still requires reaching the end of phase two, which is moving from 4 breeding pairs to 7 breeding pairs over the 3 consecutive years. That was intended as a buffer to make sure that any delisting decision was not the end-all be-all conclusion that no more recovery is needed. So I would say that in response to the question, maybe more than you wanted, but.
No, that's fair, if I could follow up. So I mean, was there any talk about the legislature having to intervene in this process?
There was talk at the time, and I haven't combed the annals, but there was talk at the time about wanting to have legislative ratification of the Wolf Plan back in 2005 after the commission adopted it. I don't know, it would be a legislative history piece of work to go back and see what the legislature did in 2005 after the commission adopted, or 2006. It wasn't contemplated that there would be constant legislative involvement in this issue, but I would say was contemplated that as much as we all would like to treat wolves like other wildlife and manage them like other wildlife, it's a different beast, and it engenders different levels of emotions. And I would say, speaking as just a member of that stakeholder group, I'm not surprised the legislature has been involved over the years in this issue, including ratifying settlement actions or actions that have come out of settlement discussions, or engaging on compensation for depredation. There were specific areas where legislative action was contemplated, including on the issue of how to compensate livestock operators for confirmed losses due to wolves, and that happened back in, I think, 2011. There were also contemplated legislative engagement areas around the status, the classification of wolves under ODF&W statutes as to, you know, this specific bill. You know, nobody talked about this in particular back in 2005, but here we are.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. We've talked about 110 wolves in Oregon. Do you have any studies or any knowledge of leakage from Idaho coming across and in creating new packs either at the border or south in Oregon?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, yes, we do. And the wolves that came to Oregon actually came from Idaho originally. And we also have information showing wolves from Oregon moving back into Idaho, moving into Washington, moving into Montana, and moving into into California. So we have documented through our own radio telemetry work and our GPS collars wolves moving back into these other states. And through genetics, we have documented wolves that have moved out of Idaho into Oregon.
Can I follow up? Yeah. Are these numbers of wolves, if we would call leakage going back and forth, are they all accounted for in your 110? Or do you have a factor that you consider to be acceptable to assume that maybe 10% are either across in Idaho or back in Oregon again?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the numbers that we provide are only wolves that are resident in Oregon. So if they have moved out of state, we no longer count those as Oregon wolves.
Follow-up? No. So then do you have an accurate count of those going back and forth? What is the percentage that move back and forth? I mean, you must obviously lose some and then you gain some back again. Is that how it works? Or
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, because Washington and Idaho are not collaring wolves at the same level that we are, we do not have information from them on wolves that are coming into the state. We know that it's happening, but we have no way of verifying that or documenting it. So in the case of a pack that we actually share with Washington, and it does go back and forth across the border, we have agreed with Washington that we count it as an Oregon pack of wolves, and Washington does not. So, and that's primarily because their denning and rendezvous site are on the Oregon side of the border. Wolves that we have collared that have ended up in Idaho, and stayed in Idaho and never come back, obviously those are not wolves that we're going to count. Similarly, wolves that have moved down into the Southern Cascades, we've had a couple that have moved into California. The one that most people are probably most familiar with is OR7, and that one spent close to a year in California, and we did not count that wolf at that point in time until he came back to Oregon and actually paired up with a female and bred. And at that point in time, we started counting that wolf as ours. We've also had a couple of other wolves that have shown up in Senator Whitsitt's area that have moved out of the Silver Lake area down into California, stayed for a while, and then come back. And those are classic dispersing wolves. And until they settle down into a spot, it really makes it difficult to say whether they're resident or not. So we really track and monitor that closely.
Follow up? Yeah. So is there a possibility that there's more wolves in Oregon that you don't know about?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, yes. We probably have a fact. Well, I don't know what the expansion factor really is, but I think it would be safe to say that we probably have right now 150-plus wolves in the state. But we only report on the ones that we can confirm and say, yes, these are the known wolves in the state. That's a hard number that we can stand behind. The expansion factor, we're just not we're not real comfortable in using that, but we know there's more.
Thank you.
Senator Timbrow.
Yeah, thank you. We established last time that the purpose of this bill, House Bill 4040, is to stop judicial review from getting in the way of the commission's decision. And I'm still wondering why that is necessary, that we do that. From my perspective, I don't like to see the legislature get involved with this. This year, as I didn't like seeing it proposed last year when the legislature was going to step in and circumvent the process. In that case, the process being the commission's decision. What would be served by stopping judicial review in the sense that how is the process of your agency able to do its work over the next couple of years harmed by that? That judicial review demand being in place.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbrough, I can't say 100% for sure that this would stop judicial review. I can't comment on that. As far as implementation of the plan with the suit in place over the decision, nothing would stop us from moving forward with implementation of the plan as written. Nothing would stop us from moving forward with the review of the Wolf Plan as already indicated. And it would not stop us from doing anything as it now sits, unless there was an injunction filed that would, outside of the judicial review or linked to it, that said until this is resolved, you cannot implement aspects of the Wolf Plan. And up to this point in time, we have not seen that.
Do you have anything further, Brett? Brett, could you provide perspective on beyond the department's work? What does the litigation mean for the next step, which is the Wolf Plan revision?
Yeah. Chair Edwards and to some extent Senator Dimbrough, your question. Aside from the agency, and even when there are notices of intent, and in this case we're beyond notices of intent and actual, we've got actual litigation filed. There is the staff time and resources. Staff time and resources get pulled into prepping for litigation and working with DOJ closely on litigation. So that is an agency impact. As far as the impact on the next step and moving into Wolf Plan revision, this is something where when that revision process happens, and assuming our working assumption is it's going to happen regardless of the this bill and litigation, because it's on the department's schedule to have happen in the spring. We've committed to that. So I think the big consideration around that is what is the state of affairs when people walk into that context and sit down around a table and work out tough issues around what do wolf protections under a revised plan look like? What do responses to depredations and management of wolves, how does that work? How does the non-lethal deterrence work happen in the different phases moving forward? All of these questions are going to be on the table, and to come to constructive conclusions, people really need to be rolling up their sleeves and talking together. And we're at a point where I think even the legislative field tour out in Wallowa County did not involve the parties sitting together on the same bus in the same meeting room, having conversations with those legislators who were out in Wallowa County at the same time. Parties have wanted to resort to their various venues for having conversations. And I think the context of coming into the Wolf Plan revision process with the uncertainty of litigation is a consideration, because anytime litigation is being brought to bear, it's there's a venue that is making a decision that inherently takes at least some of the decision-making effort or attention away from the administrative table, because the judicial branch is involved. So that's one consideration. The I guess what I would say, and not straying in too far on this, because while I'm a lawyer, I'm not working on this case. This is DOJ's matter to answer any legal questions. But the claims have not been fully briefed yet, and so we don't know at this point what specifically the legal claims are going to be, other than we know, you know, we've got litigation, and that's the fact at this point.
Thanks. Any other questions from your I think you said earlier, but I want to be clear. Will this bill lead to endangering the recovery of wolves from its current trajectory, in your opinion?
Defer to the wildlife agency and anybody from being wrong on that?
Chair Edwards, I'm not 100% sure I understand your question.
So with passage of this bill, we have a trajectory of recovery happening under the current wolf plan.
Okay.
Does passage of this bill materially change that management plan that has brought about the current recovery trajectory?
Chair Edwards, no, this bill is not going to change what happens to wolves. They are doing wolf things out on the landscape and are, like I said earlier, they are meeting all of what we predicted would be the population growth objectives based on what we've seen out of Idaho and Montana. It's matching up almost exactly, and the wolf population is growing in this state, and the wolf plan does provide protections for them and options for landowners to deal with conflict.
Okay, thank you. Sir Brzozowski.
If the commission chose not to delist, would it or would it not put the wolf in a different position than they can be considered now? Because we're the delisting, from my understanding, opens up options that may not be available if it was not delisted.
Chair Edwards, Senator Przanski, you're correct that the wolf plan, if wolves are delisted, once you reach phase three, if the commission chose to fully implement the wolf plan in phase three, they could have more liberal options for wolf management. People jump right to it, would allow hunting. It's considered and contemplated in phase three, but not guaranteed. It also offers up some more options for landowners that are experiencing damage to deal with their damage. But did that get at your question?
I think it did.
Okay,
thank you.
Chair, yep. One more question. Thanks. Ron, you mentioned the depredation, and I have been wondering about, first of all, how is the compensation program working? That was a key part of what was agreed to. And then the depredations themselves, are they, or at least the reported depredations, are they increasing at the same rate as this 35% a year growth in the population? Are we seeing a corollary growth in reported depredations?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbro. So the compensation program is actually administered by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Is the way it was set up by the legislature. And I think from our agency's perspective, it appears to be working. It's all run at the local level by wolf compensation committees, which is very appropriate. People work through that. I think the program set up in two different ways, one for compensation for actual losses, compensation for injuries, and that have been confirmed by the department. And then the third thing is for implementing non-lethal measures. And I think the biggest challenge to the compensation program has been the demand for resources exceeds the level of financial support that's been there for Department of Ag to compensate people, either for losses or for the non-lethal actions. So that's the first piece. The second piece had to do with, as the wolf population has increased, have we seen an increase in depredations? Yes, up to a point, but here in the last couple of years, depredations seem to have leveled off a little bit in Northeast Oregon. I don't want people to think, though, that just because there's not very many depredations, that may not be devastating to the landowner that has suffered those, because it certainly can be. And what we're seeing, and what appeared to be the same thing that happened in Idaho and Montana, is depredations in a lot of cases are either linked to dispersing wolves that are new to an area and don't know where the food supply is, or packs that have two or three years of successful breeding and have grown to be quite large, and their energy demands far exceed what they can easily pick up on more natural prey such as deer or elk. And if there's livestock available, they turn to those. So it seems to have steadied off a little bit, but it also is something that we expect, and we're seeing as they've moved into the Klamath, we're starting to pick some up down there. And every place they go, you end up with that. So we expect to see depredations continue to increase as the population spreads into new areas. But it hasn't necessarily increased with in the areas where we currently have wolves very well established, if that makes sense.
You have something?
Chair Edwards, yeah, if I may, and this is not germane specifically to the bill, but to Senator Brzezinski's question. On this first, the depredation issue is something where I think Oregon's approach on advancing proactive non-lethal work is something that we've really invested as a state a lot in trying to minimize conflicts, and that's part of the plan, part of the rules.
ODFNW over the years has made determinations because the agency is in the hot seat on being the one that when a depredation or an alleged depredation happens, the agency has to make the call on whether that was a confirmed or a probable or not wolf caused depredation as opposed to other causes. So in the whole battle of the science that I think is going on over did the agency rely on good or the right or enough science in the delisting decision, the agency goes through a similar competing science battle around depredation confirmations where the agency has to sort through a lot of alleged science and determine what it believes is the best science to confirm or not confirm a kill as being wolf caused. And I know some of the conclusions drawn have not in the past made the cattlemen happy. But one thing I want to circle back to is hunting, and this is something that our office has received a lot of input based on this, and I think Ron answered the question about, yes, phase three, once you go from delisting to showing an increase up to the end of phase two of seven breeding pairs and then eventually enter phase three, yes, it does authorize hunting, but I think there's a lot based on Idaho and in Montana and other states that have hunted wolves. There's a lot of energy and emotion and opposition out there related to what's happened in those states that comes into either governor's office or probably your offices too. The way Oregon's plan is set up is hunting is a management tool. Not the plan does not authorize, you know, trophy hunts or that kind of an approach. It has to be based on declines in elk or deer populations that are demonstrated to be caused by wolves. And so this was a fairly hotly debated issue back in 2005, and sure, the revision process could change it and people could come in with a different idea, but the decision then that has been codified in the OARs is to constrain hunting as a tool to management purposes so that the social conflicts that come about as a part of people thinking about wolf hunting are set within the context of management, just like lethal control is set within of wolves for livestock depredations is set within the management framework.
And so what would happen before hunting as a management tool could be implemented? I mean, to clarify,
what evidence, so
it's in the OARs, the commission could do that, but you know, does delisting and does moving to phase three all of a sudden trigger wolf tags to be sold at Bi-Mart?
No, Chair, the answer is no. I would point to Ron and Shannon though for the details.
At Chair Edwards, what the plan requires is that we would have to demonstrate as a department that wolves are causing serious depredation in an area for livestock interests, and that in that kind of a case, we might look at selectively using hunting to reduce the wolf population, or be able to demonstrate that wolves are responsible for declines in deer and elk populations, and look at maybe some kind of a limited control measure on the wolf population to try and stabilize the deer and elk population or bring it back up. So it does require triggers that we have to demonstrate have been met in order for the commission to go ahead and authorize any kind of a hunting season. And it would be limited as contemplated within the wolf plan to those circumstances and not a general season.
Not a general season, so not sport hunting.
Correct.
Like agents or?
It would be limited, Chair Edwards, to issuing of tags, but people would have to apply for those tags, and it'd be a very small amount of hunting going on at a time.
Mr. Chair, I just make a comment. Fortunately, I've been retired long enough I didn't have to deal with wolves, but I do have a lot of veterinary colleagues in Montana and Idaho that I know. Representative Whitsitt grew up in the heart of Wolf Country because the ranch she grew up on is about 50 miles from Yellowstone, where they first started dumping wolves out. So, I mean, there's a long history there. As horrendous as the actual depredation, the killing, and the maiming of livestock is, it is just the tiny tip of the iceberg as to the cost of the depredation cost to livestock producers. And you don't visualize sheep and cattle producers in the context that you might in Portland or Eugene or Roseburg or wherever. I mean, this is big country, and you turn the cattle out and the sheep out, and you see them. It's not so much the sheep, usually somebody in the vicinity of the sheep all the time. In the cattle, a lot of times, you know, you might see them every couple of weeks. That's just the way they run. So when you lose an animal to death, loss, or severe injury, and they die, usually that animal is eaten, and other predators and scavengers have picked them clean. So it's really almost impossible to demonstrate for certain that they were killed by a wolf. Much more important than the loss, though, as bad as that is the change in the behavior of the livestock. The livestock, I mean, if there's wolves up on that mountain, the livestock aren't going to go up on that mountain to feed. And if there's wolves on the mountain, those cattle are nervous, like you and I would be nervous. And they don't breed. And they don't gain. So that's the huge part of it. I mean, the death loss is horrible, the mangling of the animals is horrible, but it's that effect on the rangeland that is driving people out of business. So, I mean, I think when we talk about depredation, we need to go just a little bit further than that cow that was hamstrung and eaten alive. I mean, you've got to go to what it's really costing.
Plenty of conflict to go around. Other questions for the department or from Brett? Thank you each for being here, both to provide the department perspective, your perspective, Brett, on somebody that's been working on this issue for a long time. I appreciate you, each of you, being here on this difficult issue. So, thank you. So we're in work session, folks, and I am looking for a motion on the bill.
Chair Edwards, pardon me. Chair Edwards, I move House Bill 4040A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved House Bill 4040A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Let's have some discussion. I guess we've had a lot of discussion. So, Senator Brzozowski.
Mr. Chair, hearing all the testimony and stuff, I think I'm pretty well put out there. My concern is the public process and the process that's been used and why we're being asked to come into this. I will say, and I'll note, I've got constituents on both sides of this issue. In fact, I've got two of them in this room on each side of the issue. So, you know, this is one of those situations for me, it's process. I am concerned as to us being asked to intervene at this stage into a judicial proceeding. And I'll tell you what I took away from the proponents was that their main concern is that because they're not a party to the lawsuit, they are going to be cut out of any type of potential settlement negotiations on the lawsuit that could, in fact, have a direct impact on the Wolf Plan. And I respect that and understand that. But I think there's a way to take care of that concern without us going down this path. My understanding from what the last testimony they gave us at the last hearing is that they are now interveners. We could, in fact, have in legislation that basically states that while this litigation is pending, that there will be no changes to the Oregon Wolf Plan while this litigation is going on, unless all of the parties and interveners to the lawsuit are at the table and they come to some agreement. That seems to be an area, an opportunity to allow for the proponents to feel, I would hope, more comfortable, because that's what I took away from their testimony, was that they were concerned that they were not going to be able to be at that table. So I do believe that we can, in fact, accommodate those concerns by passing legislation that would prohibit that plan from being changed without having all of the individuals at the table and having hopefully a constructive discussion as to what, if any, changes should be made, or allowing the court to make its ruling as to whether or not the agency slash commission actually carried out its task as required by law. So that's something I put out there. I'd be very, and I apologize to the chair as to, this is something I came with up as observations over the weekend and did not realize that the bill was actually going to be moving to this stage for the work session based on other comments I'd heard from other people within this legislative process.
All sorts of, I can't tell you how many second, third, fourth, and tenth hand comments I've heard about this bill and all sorts of other bills today in particular. So, because it is our committee's deadline for moving legislation. I guess, you know, a piece of discussion that I have is I think it's easy to conflate this bill with whether or not you support wolf reintroduction and kind of, I feel like the, or wolf reestablishment. And, you know, there are folks who have an interest in not seeing this bill move forward that it seems like have tried to make that distinction. Like, if you're for the bill, you're against wolves. And I just don't accept that premise. And it'll be characterized however people want to characterize it in newsletters and action alerts, but I just don't agree. I want to see wolves across the landscape of Oregon. But on natural resource and the environment issues, and this goes to my comments before we open the work session, they're so contentious. And I do not think that litigation is the way to create a productive posture for working out these issues. I totally understand that it is an accepted practice and a common practice among certain groups and a strategy, and I understand that. And it's clearly, in my view, and in emails that I've been told about, it has been a clear strategy, and I think Brett talked to that earlier about, well, you know, we'd rather have wolf plan revision prior to delisting, and there's a lot of contention around this issue. I think forcing people into the room, a conference room, not a courtroom, is a more productive setting, and people have squared off, groups have squared off, and everybody's preparing for a lawsuit, and I don't think that produces as good of outcomes. I appreciate your perspective that you have driven on this, Senator Przanski, and, you know, pushing on this and your thoughtfulness about the issue, because it's difficult. You have hardcore environmental advocates in your district, as do I, and you have ranchers in your district, and it's a tough one.
Yep.
It's a tough one. Senator Denbrough, I feel like you want to say something.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, just, you know, I feel that, and, you know, and I've made this point before, it's hard for me really to see the purpose of this legislation. You know, I think that, you know, certainly I also would like to see the parties get together and work things out. If our compensation program isn't doing all that it could, then I'd like to see them get together and figure out ways to improve it. You know, if in fact there are, you know, wider ranging effects of wolf presence on, you know, herds or flocks, you know, I'd like to see them get together and do some science on that to see, you know, I mean, is this really, you know, is this really happening? What is going on with the state of our, you know, our herds, you know, are they really less healthy and breeding less successfully in a, you know, in a real way since the wolves have been reintroduced. Those things I think all need to happen. But I just don't see that pursuing, you know, the legislature stepping in and saying that, you know, we need to take charge of this process. Whether, you know, we come in and say you must maintain a delist or you must be, you know, or you must delist, I just don't see that that's our place to do it. And I, you know, and what I heard from the agency was, you know, that there's not, we're not in a danger situation. We're not seeing, you know, dramatically increasing examples of depredation. We're not, if the judicial review goes forward, that's not going to change their ability to manage the wolves. So, you know, therefore, I ask myself, why are we doing this? And, you know, unless I can really feel, and at this point, I don't feel that I have a satisfactory answer to that, so I can't vote for the bill.
No. Other comments, Senator Olson? No? Senator, what's it? No? I think my final comment, I think it's my final comment anyway, is that I hear what you're saying, Senator Denbrough. I agree that I did not hear that the department is in dire straits around their ability to manage wolves. I certainly haven't concluded that from the testimony. What I have concluded from the issue is that this is as much about the posture, the strategy, the posture, and the process as wolf plan revision, review and revision move forward. And you know, I think it's entirely appropriate for the legislature to weigh in if legislators have an opinion about that, just like we've weighed in on legislation that has influenced other lawsuits. I mean, in 2013, I think, is when we had the bill around, you know, Pacific Corp was suing the Department of Energy around the energy supplier assessment, and in response to that lawsuit, some of us, and I was one of the lead legislators on that bill, drafted a bill that changed the energy supplier assessment and budgeting process, the budget development process that led to setting of the rates, et cetera, et cetera. So as public policymakers, we do intervene when we think that it's healthier to force a situation or to resolve a situation rather than letting it happen in a courtroom. So I don't think that it's without precedent that the legislature has taken action in the face of lawsuits. And that's just the first one that comes to my mind. But any other questions? I mean, not questions, but comments, discussion. Okay. Could you call the roll?
Senator Denbrough.
No.
Senator Brzozinski.
No.
Senator Whitsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Yes.
Chair Edwards.
Chair votes aye. The motion carries, and it will be carried. Just a moment.
Yep.
Motion or the bill will be carried by Senator Hansel. Yes.
Mr. Chair, give a notice of possible minority report.
Okay. Senator Brzozinski has served notice of a potential possible minority report. And we will close the work session on House Bill 4040A. And
I may join him, I'm not sure.
Okay. Senator Denbrough said he may join him. And we're done for the day. We're adjourned.